regret it if I don't say it. She carefully told him how she felt. He took a deep breath and told her he didn't want to hurt her. She assured him that she needed nothing from him. "You don't have responsibility for my heartbreak," she said. "This is what my heart has done. I didn't think I could feel this way again after losing my husband, and it's really good for me to know I can go to this place with someone." She knew she couldn't think about love as something she could avoid for the rest of her life. She was capable of getting close to someone else. She wanted another relationship, even if it wasn't with him. He received her confession calmly. He told her he would never forget her. As she suspected, he had nothing more to give her. No confession of mutual desire, no 11th-hour fling. A few nights later, they went out to dinner, and their rapport was still there. They parted as friends. What strikes me about Eleanor is how determined she was not to fall prey to her unrequited love. She couldn't control her feelings, but she could control how she acted in response to them, and let them move her to a new understanding of what her future could bring. "I have thrown myself off the ledge before, and I decided I wasn't going to do it this time," she said. "What I have to hold on to now is much more important to me than if I had actually gone to bed with him." Eleanor's story shows that the unwanted woman can use what she's going through for a larger purpose. She can know what she wants isn't possible. She can fantasize, knowing that her fantasies will never be real. She can experience love without real expectations, and with a Don Quixote freedom to do what she needs to do with the feeling. Clinical psychologist Jill Weber, the author of Having Sex, Wanting Intimacy, Why Women Settle for One-Sided Relationships, says women may be drawn to unrequited love in times of transition. "They are trying to figure something out," she said. "They're not ready for commitment, but this allows them to feel desire at a distance without risking rejection. It's what the self needs to do." As in the pre-adolescent and teen years, unrequited love can be a necessary phase for an adult, helping her learn or relearn how to love within the relative safety of a one-sided attraction. The key for Eleanor was adult-size restraint, which seems anathema to passion. She put rules around her obsession and, within those rules, found pleasure and insight. Social psychologist Sharon Bream has observed a similar phenomenon in religious traditions, which place ecstatic spiritual love within the context of a disciplined life of devotion. The 16th century nun, Teresa of Avila, wrote of mood swings that went from euphoria to despair to blank exhaustion as she experienced love for an unknowable God. She felt mystical moments of union, like rain falling from the heavens into a river, as well as times of panic when she could not feel as close to God as she wanted. All this took place within a life of strict discipline, untenable to most of us. But there is something important in the combination of order and disorder that characterized Teresa of Avila's ecstasy. And in a thoroughly contemporary and a religious manner, Eleanor's approach to her crush. Eleanor worked with her passion and let it teach her. We don't have to become nuns. We don't have to stifle all feeling. But we may need to learn, as individuals and as a culture, ways to honor passion by confining and using it instead of letting it diminish us. 9. Letting go. How obsession ends. B had not answered his phone in days. One morning I tried him from my office at school. "Phillips," he said as soon as he heard my voice, I'm cutting you off. We can never speak again. He hung up. I canceled my classes for the rest of the day. I went back to my apartment and got into bed. I felt weak and had a fever. The next morning, I vomited. Immediately after, I felt, if not normal, that I could glimpse normalcy. My temperature went back down. I was no longer possessed. I was shaken and alone. I had failed, but I could move forward. That 24-hour flu was my exorcism. The demon was gone. The end of my obsession began with the words, "We can never speak again." B ended all possibility. He had never done that before. I was ready. At long last, I had to accept the repeated rejections, the girlfriend he couldn't bring himself to leave, the simple fact that after 6 months of strenuous effort, we still weren't together. Dorothy Tenov would have called what I went through starvation. The lack of consistent attention and caring from B, on top of all the accumulated evidence that a relationship wasn't going to happen. After that final phone call, I no longer had anything to feed my hopes. A couple of weeks later, I left Pittsburgh for a while. The trip, planned before my obsession began, was fortuitous. I needed to wake up with a couple hundred miles between us instead of a few blocks. Finding distance, in real miles or metaphorical ones, can be crucial to ending romantic obsession. Maria, the woman obsessed with a man who worked at a sporting goods store a few miles south of her home, stopped driving by the store. Even the sight of it, she knew, would re-trigger her attraction, making her miserable. She did all her errands in the other direction. A conclusive rejection that ends all contact, as heartless as it might seem, is a blessing for the unwanted woman whose obsession has become compulsive, demoralizing, or destructive. Ambivalence and mixed messages are her curse. So are the intermittent positive rewards of sex, affection, friendship, and other kinds of attention. When people confide in me that they are being aggressively pursued, I tell them the story of my final phone call with B. I urge them to be as unequivocal as he finally was. When unrequited love gets out of hand, the moral dilemma of the beloved boils down to this: rejection is mercy. There are limits to this idea. Plenty of aspiring lovers persist beyond an unequivocal no, and plenty of beloveds won't or can't be so clear. The unwanted woman who wants to stop being consumed by unrequited love may need another way out, a way that isn't dependent on what the beloved does. How, then, does romantic obsession end? Just as there are many ways to be in obsessive love, there are many ways to get out of it, though common themes and larger lessons do emerge. Most of the women in this book, including me, didn't follow any one particular strategy or program. Some found solace in support groups. Some got professional help, an option people whose obsession is limiting their ability to function or spurring them to destructive behavior should seek. Rest assured, with rare exceptions, unrequited love does end. One of the legs that unrequited love stands on is the importance of the beloved, all the goals and dreams you've imbued him with. The goals and dreams don't have to end, but their association with the beloved does. Renowned physician Ibn Sina realized this back in the 10th century, when he prescribed refuting the lovesick patient's idealized notions as nothing but a delusion, and pointing out the beloved's character flaws. Take the magic away. Unlink the goals. Dissolve the crystals. He also advised strenuous distractions, hunting, intellectual debates, and other physically and mentally challenging activities. Ibn Sina's remedy, as psychologist Frank Tallis points out, is echoed today in a number of therapeutic approaches rooted in cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. CBT helps people identify and change the beliefs that direct self-destructive and self-defeating thoughts and actions. If you believe the beloved is the only man on earth who can give you the love you need and you must be with him, you'll continue to behave accordingly. CBT prompts the patient to challenge the strength of the belief. How, for example, could your beloved be the only man who can give you the love you need if he doesn't text you back? How could he be fulfilling his long-ago promise to spend his life with you if he won't even agree to let you see him? Several CBT-based approaches emphasize disrupting the unsatisfying cycle of the reward-seeking behaviors of obsessive love. You may look for solace in photos of your beloved, but the relief is only momentary. The more you give in to the impulse, the more accustomed your brain becomes to this quick yet weak dose of reassurance. It becomes a habit that feels crucial to your very survival. Not long after you stop gazing at the picture, or even while you're still looking at it, the craving to reconnect builds again. Cognitive behavioral therapy essentially guides patients to recognize the craving as misguided urgings of their brain, not the call of a truly essential need, and then directs their attention to an activity or thought that's more beneficial. This approach taps into the brain's neuroplasticity, the capacity to take on new roles and functions in response to changes in the brain's environment. CBT, in short, can literally transform the way the brain works. A small study of patients with obsessive-compulsive disorder found that after 10 weeks of CBT, 2/3 of the patients suffered fewer OCD symptoms, and their brain chemistry shifted accordingly. When OCD symptoms are intense, more glucose is metabolized in the area of the brain that signals when something has gone wrong with an expected reward. After the treatment, glucose metabolism in that area decreased, along with the symptoms. Los Angeles-based clinical psychologist Jennifer Tates uses a CBT-based technique to help her clients gain more control over their thoughts and their behavior. People think that if they have a desire, they need to act on it. They think it's cathartic to send an email or talk about the person, but that's a myth, she said. If you change your behavior, you can change the way you feel. If you don't talk about him, your feelings may pass faster, and you'll surely live better. She teaches a tool called Opposite to Emotion Action. Instead of giving in to the urge to satisfy your desire to connect, you gently avoid it and do the opposite. Put away the pictures, delete the person's number, and refrain from talking about him. Key to Tates's process is having her patients focus on values. She asks them to assess what they want out of life. Her therapeutic approach helps them move toward a renewed commitment to their personal values. Values motivate people, she said. If someone values integrity and can really look at that, that can help more than anything else. Assessing values helps them see that their struggle is for something bigger and better in their life, not the particular person they've been obsessing over. If people realize that they care about taking care of themselves and having compassion for themselves, they'll see that they are not going to get those things by seeing someone whose love is not reciprocal. Tates's approach struck me as a concrete way to dismantle goal linking by guiding the patient to see how her higher order goals have little to do with the lower order goal of a relationship with the beloved. Tates emphasized that moving beyond the fixation on the beloved can be a really tortuous and really brutal process, but keeping your values in mind can help. It's almost like a firefighter goes into a building and is willing to endure the flames to rescue a baby, she said. For several of the women I interviewed, the beliefs they once had about their beloved dissolved in an abrupt epiphany, as if the curtain had been drawn back on their Wizard of Oz and he was revealed to be nothing more than human, and not the right human for them to love. Some of these turning points seem, like my fever, sent from some divine place, as if Aphrodite and Athena agreed that it was time for the madness to cease. One woman's obsession ended in the Oakland firestorm of 1991. Her home burned down, and all her possessions were destroyed. She and her husband had to focus on basic needs, consoling their son, finding a place to live, buying underwear and toothpaste. Her unrequited love, for months the guiding force for everything she did, seemed extraneous. The fire was a cleansing, she said. You lose your history, and you're down to just your physical being. You don't have your stuff anymore. The facade of the drama, the passion, was part of that stuff. You get down to your core life. Other women undergo a long, gradual process before their moment of realization. Amalia, a 54-year-old inn owner, spent her early 20s obsessed with Rick, a close friend she met while working at a restaurant. He had a drawn, bony face, like Daniel Day-Lewis in The Unbearable Lightness of Being, and a tortured spirit, a seductive combination for her and, she suspected, many others. They were roommates and occasional lovers, but he always pulled away from her when he sensed she wanted too much. She believed she represented stability and unconditional love as he immersed himself in the creative ferment of film school in New York City. She was more grounded than he was, plus she had a dog they both adored. When living together became too fraught, they decided he should move out. She nursed hopes that once he left, their relationship would grow stronger. Then she discovered she was pregnant. He urged her to get an abortion. After a lot of soul-searching, she reluctantly went ahead with terminating the pregnancy. He stayed with her throughout the procedure and cared for her afterward. Then he began to extricate himself from me, even from our friendship, she said. A few months after she lost touch with him, she spotted him as she was heading into a movie theater in Midtown Manhattan to see The Last Metro. The sight of him across the avenue, laughing and happy with a friend, made her feel so ill that she couldn't make it through the movie. She got into a cab and threw up all over the seat. She didn't see Rick again for about 2 years. She got married and had a baby son. One morning, as she was strolling her baby on Manhattan's Upper East Side, she spotted Rick riding on his bicycle and waved. As he approached, she watched him, fascinated. She knew she didn't love him anymore, but not long before that morning, her husband had mentioned his name. They both worked in the film industry, and she'd felt her heart twinge with the memory of what he had meant to her. She greeted him warmly. "This is my son," she said. "You're not going to believe what I named him." "Rick?" "What?" she gasped, startled. In that moment, she told me, she saw him for who he really was in a way she never could when she was in love with him. There was something so heinous and narcissistic in his belief that I would actually name my child after him. I saw how ludicrous he was. He thought I still had that much unresolved feeling for him. It blew me away. I already felt I had moved on, and I was grateful for where I was at in life. But if I had any feeling left for him, it vaporized in that moment. It was the ultimate closure. She graciously corrected him. "No, Rick. I named him Monty." It was the name of the dog she had when they lived together. Like Amalia, Rena, the opera singer, took years to get over her love for her college conductor. She saw him from time to time in the music world, and their encounters were often disappointing, sometimes devastatingly so. At graduate school, she was thrilled to learn he would be visiting for a professional meeting. When she spotted his bobbing walk in the distance, she called out to him. She was certain he heard her, but he ignored her and walked in the opposite direction. At his conducting debut with a major symphony orchestra, she went backstage to congratulate him. She found herself in a throng of many adoring female acolytes who, she suspected, felt for him as she had. To see them all assembled made me feel embarrassed and pathetic, she said. Then her own career began to take off. She was asked to perform an orchestral song cycle by Leonard Bernstein at a prestigious music festival. The lyrics, a poem by Conrad Aiken, were all about lost love. Music I heard with you was more than music, and bread I broke with you was more than bread. Now that I am without you, all is desolate. All that was once so beautiful is dead. While she rehearsed the piece, she sometimes choked up, thinking of the conductor. In performance, she was flawless. The song cycle was met with a thunderous ovation. Afterward, to her utter surprise, her beloved conductor walked through the backstage door and embraced her. "It was a triumph on my own terms," she said. "I now had the bravery to sing without emotions overcoming me. It was a good apotheosis and really allowed me to let go." She didn't need him in order to become the performer she wanted to be, and the idea of him no longer held the same power. There are ways to catalyze the moment of awakening that ends romantic obsession. Emma, a documentary filmmaker, began practicing Buddhism in her early 30s. Her teacher, a monk named Peter, suggested she move into the Zen monastery where he worked. The idea of a semi-monastic existence appealed to her. She had been bedridden for several weeks with chickenpox, followed by a bout of mononucleosis. The isolation of being sick for so long had left her with the feeling that something was profoundly missing from her life. Though her career was showing strong signs of promise, her parents didn't really understand what she was doing. She was burdened with the feeling that she wasn't meeting their expectations. Deepening her practice at the monastery offered solace. "You bring your hands together, and it's like a wake-up bell," she said. "There's a way you become very, very close to people when you sit in silence for hours on end." The monastery had a strict rule for newcomers: no relationships for the first 6 months. They've seen that when people first move in, they are very sensitive and more vulnerable than they normally are, Emma said. The restriction didn't stop her from becoming obsessed with Jack, a senior monk. When she sat down to meditate at 5 each morning, all she could think about was having sex with him. Buddhist monks don't have to be celibate, and she knew Jack wanted her, too. She took her dilemma to her teacher. "I know there's this 6-month rule, but I just want to hop into the sack with this guy," she confessed. "I can't stop thinking about him. We're made for each other." Her teacher, Peter, told her a story. In his 20s, he traveled to Asia to escape the violence in his native Ireland and seek enlightenment. He moved into a monastery in a remote forest in Thailand, but all he could think about was raunchy sex. Pornographic scenes invaded his meditation. He went to his teacher for help. The teacher sent him to live in a brothel for a year. His explanation was that he needed to study desire. Emma was shocked. "Did you have sex?" she asked. Peter said that at first he did, but then the prostitutes started seeking his friendship. They shared with him the pain in their lives. "I became their brother," he said. "I couldn't objectify them, and I couldn't see them in this raunchy and sexy way. He stopped sleeping with the prostitutes, and his lust faded. Then Peter gave Emma his advice. If you want to have sex with Jack, have sex with Jack. But wait 2 weeks. Try studying your desire. She followed his advice. The more she held back, the more Jack pursued her. There were no locks on the bedroom doors, and he would wait naked in her room for her. But she didn't give in. She began to see him more clearly. It was like being zoomed in on a close-up shot, and then the lens slowly opens up to a medium shot, and I saw all these layers of him I couldn't see before because we weren't sleeping together, she said. This nuance gets crushed once you go fuck someone. You just want to merge. Her longing for him, she realized, was about an ideal, not a reality. The more I felt I had to be with him, the more I was not really seeing him, she said. I was focused on how I was finally going to feel once I was with him. I was finally going to be really myself. I was finally going to land in the world. Once she studied her desire, she realized how unrealistic that line of thinking was and how little she felt for him. It's always simpler the way you fantasize about it, she said. You don't fantasize about the messiness of intimacy. It never includes the stuff that really gets on your nerves. It filters all that out. I took what was attractive about him and purified it, and imagined that being with him was somehow going to make me feel whole. What Emma learned, to sit with her feelings instead of acting on them, is part of the strategy behind dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, developed by psychologist Marcia Linehan to treat chronically suicidal women. DBT emphasizes both self-acceptance and the need to change destructive behaviors. DBT programs combine individual therapy sessions with phone coaching and skills groups to help clients learn how to manage anger, depression, impulsivity, stress, relationships, and other challenges. Barry Rosenfeld, a psychology professor at Fordham University, created a stalking treatment program that uses DBT. Participants, all criminal offenders who are court-ordered to participate in treatment, are taught to use mindfulness techniques to observe their urges to contact the target of their harassment without acting on them. A lot of offenders are just not accustomed to thinking before they act, Rosenfeld said. A lot of people are very impulsive. Something happens, and then they do something to react. We are trying to break that chain and get people to tolerate feeling bad and not go right into action to stop feeling bad. None of the people who completed Rosenfeld's pilot program were arrested again for a stalking offense, while nearly half of all convicted stalkers overall reoffend. This idea of learning how to sit with your feelings is useful in controlling less extreme forms of pursuit. It's at the heart of the approach developed by Rhonda Findling, who counsels women all over the world about how to stop the obsessive urge to connect and get over romantic obsession. She recently developed a Don't Text That Man app that helps you keep track of the last time you contacted your beloved. The app delivers encouraging bits of advice. Isn't it better to be the girl who got away rather than the clingy, desperate girl? The approach may be a bit techno-cheesy, but I view Findling as a valuable figure in the self-help world. She doesn't shame women about not being feminine enough, and she doesn't tell them not to initiate relationships. Rather, she urges them to stop compulsive pursuit and regain self-control. Her core message is an important one. You have to learn to tolerate your distress. Otherwise, you'll become masochistic, offering yourself up again and again to the pain of rejection. What you have to do is go against the grain, Findling said. You're thinking, he has to see how much I love and desire him. Containing your feelings and waiting doesn't feel natural. It goes against the instinct. For self-control to work, she said, women need to suffer out their pain instead of contacting the beloved in an effort to get rid of it. When your beloved doesn't respond to you, that in itself is a real loss. It doesn't matter how long the relationship lasted or whether there was ever a real relationship. You need to allow yourself to mourn, just as anyone who has lost someone important needs to mourn. She tells women to expect to go through stages, much like Elizabeth Kubler-Ross described in her famous 1969 book, On Death and Dying. Denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. They will need similar forms of support. Friends they can confide in, creative outlets, structured time, physical exercise. If you need to express your feelings, Findling suggests you write the beloved a letter. Just don't send it. Some women, however, are released from obsession precisely because they had a chance to communicate what they felt to their beloved. Carolyn, the young woman who was obsessed with her art school classmate, found solace after she gave him a diary of her feelings. Sonia, the design researcher, struggled with her feelings after months of mixed signals and disappointments. She had never overtly pursued her beloved. She had never told him how much she cared about him and how much he had angered her. Once she carefully confessed to him, the last traces of her obsession went away. The difference between the unwanted woman who needs to stop connecting and the one who needs to connect lies in her degree of self-control and her level of expectation. Carolyn and Sonia reached out after they had stopped hoping for love, or for that matter, any particular response. They needed to unburden themselves of what they were feeling, and they did so with dignity. Los Angeles clinical psychologist Jennifer Tates cautioned that though this approach can be helpful for some people, it's risky. It can backfire and trigger a mini relapse, she said. The thing that I say to people is, do you want to be right or live a good life? Over a year after my obsession with B subsided, I went back to Pittsburgh for a visit. My friends and I drove around the city on a Saturday night looking for a place to have coffee. Every favorite haunt was too crowded or closed. We decided to go to the Squirrel Hill Cafe in my old neighborhood, where Bea and I had spent a lot of time. I had wanted to avoid it, but the longer we searched for a suitable place, the more inevitable it seemed. Indeed, when we walked in, Bea was sitting at a table near the door with a group of my favorite students from my last year teaching in Pittsburgh. After I caught up with my students, I invited Bea to sit with me at another table. I told him I was working in radio again and living in Woodstock with Bill. B said he had been wondering where I went. He knew I left town because he stopped hearing me on the radio on Saturday mornings. It was nice to be the one who disappeared mysteriously, leaving him guessing, I thought. We talked about what had gone on between us. He said he was still trying to figure out why he acted the way he did. I said I regretted what I had become. It wasn't like me to be a crazed stalker, I said wryly. We smiled at each other. I experienced a faint reprise of the old attraction, though I knew I wouldn't act on it. I felt self-possessed again, the way I did when we were classmates, when I was mildly attracted to him but hadn't given him any power over me. I'd made my comeback from the wreck I'd been. I was building a good, sane life without him. Facing him from that vantage point gave me some of the thrill of what I might call revenge, but none of the consequences. And so I return to the question that launched this book. Why did I ever give him all that power? Why did I get so obsessed? My outsized reaction to being unwanted didn't, as far as I can determine, stem from an early psychological wound or malfunction of attachment. What sent me into the psychological and neurochemical maelstrom I've detailed in this book was nothing that exceptional. I was lost. I'd suffered a breakup of a serious relationship, a major predictor of unwanted pursuit. I'd had several bouts of anxiety and depression since my teens and was desperate to avoid another one. My teaching job was temporary, my radio job part-time, and my writing was in a postgraduate school no-man's land. I didn't know what I was going to do with my career. Several of my closest friends were leaving Pittsburgh, getting married, having children, or moving in with someone. Both my siblings had growing families. I had lived in 5 different states during my 20s, moving with a kind of erratic determination between going to school and radio jobs. I was weary of starting over yet again and of being on my own. My life illustrated the downside of what social scientists now call extended adolescence. Delaying family and a settled profession, the markers of adult life, has its freedoms and pleasures. But such a prolonged period of uncertainty, exacerbated by an economy that increasingly feeds off of part-time, contract, and internship labor, none of which requite workers' longings for commitment, can also engender despair. I felt lonely and ashamed. Despite my heartfelt efforts in work and love, nothing I did seemed to amount to much. None of these challenges, all common and very human, were insurmountable. But their combined force made me vulnerable when I drew close to B, a man who at first saw me as I so badly wanted to see myself, smart, desirable, strong. Meeting my husband so soon after B cut me off gave me what I was chasing so hard, the self-esteem that comes from being wanted by a good man, followed by love, marriage, and a family. I don't want this to sound smug or easy. Early in my relationship with Bill, I returned to therapy to help myself become more emotionally self-reliant. However supportive Bill was, I was dealing with many of the same life challenges I had before I met him, and I had to realize that he wasn't responsible for fixing them all. For our love to endure, I had to shake off the illusion that his attention was going to take care of my well-being as I sorted my life out. As a girl who came of age in the era of the Cinderella complex, I had never bought into the idea that a man should provide for all my material needs. Yet, until this turning point in my life, the myth persisted that a partner would provide completely for my emotional security. My relationship with Bill meant I skipped a very difficult stage endured by many people coping with unrequited love, walking into the future without a partner. But that doesn't have to mean walking into the future without love. The role of good love in easing a failed obsession isn't limited to replacement romances. Caroline Hostetler, a behavioral neuroscientist at Oregon Health and Science University, studies the impact of social attachment on addictive disorders. She takes issue with researchers who maintain that because the neural processes of love, social attachment, and addiction have so much in common, the same pharmacological treatments for addiction might apply to people suffering from the loss of love. This line of thinking, she says, misses a crucial point. Social attachments are necessary to our welfare, whereas drugs and alcohol are not. The fact that both social attachments and substance abuse trigger reward systems suggests that quality relationships of all sorts can neurologically compete with substance addiction. Maybe social relationships can be the more powerful addiction, she says. The obsessed lover is caught in a bind when her quest for attachment to the beloved becomes unhealthy and compulsive. Seeking other human connections, supportive family and friends, therapy groups, community, can help give her addiction to him some healthy neurochemical competition. Melissa, a 58-year-old office manager, was in an obsessive, on-again, off-again affair with Gordon for 3 years. 2 months after they got together, she found out that he was seeing another woman. He described it as a temporary relationship. Then Melissa found out he had been with her for 2 years and owned a house with her. The news tore Melissa up. She spent months crying and writing letters to him that she never sent. The only comfort she could find seemed to be with him. Their affair resumed. "I should have run, but I didn't," she said. At first, they spent every weekend together, fishing on his boat. Melissa loved the peacefulness of being out on the water with him and having him all to herself. When his girlfriend found out what was going on, Gordon told Melissa that she didn't mind. Melissa started to, though. "He could have her and me, too, and I felt cheated," she said. "I began to lose my confidence and self-respect." Even though she tried to stop seeing Gordon, she let the affair drag out for 4 years. "I just turned into a dead person. I wasn't doing anything but living for him and going to work so I could survive." Then she felt the pull of a different kind of attachment. Her brother, who lived in Florida and suffered from schizophrenia and advancing dementia, was dying. She decided to leave Tennessee to be with him and her sister, who lived nearby and would help with his care. "That became my priority," she said. "I knew my relationship wasn't giving anything to me anymore, and I knew if I didn't leave, I'd be stuck indefinitely in the Twilight Zone, doing the same thing over and over again. I didn't want to leave, but I just felt I had to. I couldn't go on." She sold her house and left the state. "I knew I could do this thing, move away and leave him and care for my brother," she said. "I could be the winner a little bit." For the next 2 years, she was swept up in her brother's needs. He required constant care. "He was always after attention from doctors, nurses, me," she said. "I could never stop to rest or relax." Although it was exhausting, it broke her tie to Gordon. "I focused on my brother rather than myself, and how sad and lonely I felt." The move, which brought her closer to other family members, made her feel more confident and stable. All she had to do was look at her brother, who needed her so much. Everything she'd been through with Gordon felt a little silly in comparison. This renewed human connection could sustain her as she finally gained distance from Gordon. Psychologists call heartbreak social pain. Rejection hurts so much because we've lost a social connection. Social pain is an adaptation. Our ancestors needed other people to protect themselves from wild animals, hostile tribes, and the elements. To be excluded from a community was a life-threatening proposition, so the strife of being rejected had to push people to respond as they would to a physical injury. They had to do something to repair it. Social pain and physical pain involve similar areas of the brain and cause similar reactions: weeping, screaming, seeking help. The caring presence of other people helps alleviate hurt feelings and physical pain. Several studies show that higher levels of social support are associated with lower levels of pain in labor, after surgery, and in people suffering from chronic pain and heart disease. Melissa could, in today's terms, take care of herself. She'd been on her own for years. But what helped ease the blow of rejection was reconnecting with her siblings. They needed her, and she needed them. Loved ones and other forms of social attachment are crucial, helping us fend off all manner of challenges to our ability to thrive. In a society where more people live alone than ever before, it's easy to forget that closeness to others isn't a luxury, something to seek out when we don't have anything else to do. It's tempting to live out too much of our social lives online, at the expense of real-life human contact. If we isolate ourselves, we risk being all the more vulnerable when someone walks into our lives and triggers all that unsatisfied need. Yet there is no question that social attachments to family and friends are very different from romantic love. Even the best strategies for ending romantic obsession can feel very much like paces to put yourself through, emotional homework, necessary but not nearly as exciting as what we left behind. They're meant to help us stop suffering, but they can seem to require us to stop living so large, so unrealistically. We must become sensible. The pull of unrequited love can stem from a longing for transcendence, a need to experience great, impractical feeling. So, for some of us, moving beyond obsession may entail finding something or someone with a similar ineffable power. Lena, an Italian language specialist and 46-year-old single mother, expressed this idea perfectly in a bit of woodsy folklore. They say the antidote grows right next to the poison. Lena is exactly the kind of person I'm talking about. She does need to live large, whether by investigating the intricacies of Italian etymology or immersing herself in a new and enchanting friendship. She has a sharp, analytical mind and a mystical, emotional sensibility guided by moments of synchronicity. Her daughter was conceived with a man she had spent a passionate night with in a lightning storm. He lived in Greece and saw his daughter only sporadically. Lena cherished her daughter, but raising her alone was difficult. She had little money and little help. Her parents had died when she was in her 20s. She met Bartolo through a mutual friend when he was visiting from Italy. They connected immediately over their mutual interest in languages, geeking out over etymology and the connections among Italian, Greek, Latin, and Sanskrit. They soon discovered that they were born on the same day, 3 hours apart, which Lena took as a sign that there was something bigger at work. They were meant to be together. She nursed that feeling for 2 years, despite the fact that Bartolo disappointed her again and again. When she and her daughter visited him in Italy, he became jealous of the 4-year-old girl and kicked them out of his home. On a trip to Romania, he abandoned her after a disagreement and sent a text to let her know where he'd moved her luggage. They got together again in Mexico. Finally, Lena said, everything felt perfect, a honeymoon. Then his attention wandered to a Venetian woman they'd met in a restaurant. At the end of the trip, when he put Lena on a bus to the airport instead of driving her there, she knew he planned to seek the woman out. Lena's love for Bartolo, she realized, left her in a constant state of longing. It had to come to an end. Lena sat down in a daze in the airport lounge. She wondered what was going to become of her life. She was depleted emotionally and financially. Then a beautiful blue-eyed man sat down 3 chairs away from her. That's when everything changed, she said. She started talking to the man, whose name was Oliver. When they got in line to board the plane, they realized that they were seated next to each other. What are the chances of that? She said, and laughed. She made him show her his ticket to prove it. Oliver, an economics researcher, counted the number of seats on the plane and, to her delight, started calculating the odds. They talked all the way home. When she learned that he was 20 years younger than she was, she found it incomprehensible that there could be such an old soul in a young body. As she described how quickly her feelings for him developed, an immediate, unconditional love, I feared she was telling a story of replacing one unrealistic love with another. But she assured me there was a critical difference. She didn't need anything from Oliver. They kept in touch. She cut her ties to Bartolo. Meeting Oliver created a new standard for her. I asked myself, would I want the kind of relationship I had with Bartolo for my daughter? That's a simple one. I would not want this for my daughter. One day she received a text from Oliver's roommate. Oliver had been in a motorcycle accident. He was in a coma and might not live. As soon as she could, Lena drove down to Baltimore from her home in upstate New York. At the hospital, Oliver's family members, believing he wasn't going to make it, were coming in to say goodbye. They were speaking about him in the third person, in the past tense, as if he was already gone, she said. Things like, Oliver was so good at the piano. Oliver was this. Oliver was that. They were living their greatest fear. When she had a moment alone with Oliver, she touched his ears and stroked his cheekbone. She whispered to him, I haven't had time to tell you how I feel, because I haven't known you long enough, but I have this difficult-to-explain love for you. I want you to understand there are things for you to do here. Lena left the hospital, not knowing what was going to happen. But on her drive home, she got a text from his roommate. He opened his eyes. A few days later, Oliver was well enough to try to talk his doctors into letting him leave the hospital. She felt her presence had been a part of what saved him. During his recovery, I asked her, if he called you tomorrow and said he didn't want to see you again, would you be okay? Yes, she said. I can feel for him with no boundaries because I have no expectations. Indeed, Lena never had a romance with Oliver. In the 2 years since his recovery, he has visited her several times. He shares a close bond with her daughter, whom he fondly calls his niece. He helps Lena around her house and property and with her writing. I'm an older woman he trusts, she said. They've tested the boundaries of their friendship. On one visit, they fooled around. But she quickly realized their relationship wasn't meant to be sexual. The very fact that she and Oliver never became a couple, and she feels probably never could be, has great meaning for her. Oliver primes me for great love, she said. To love, I have to take care of my own emotional life, and he helps me do that. One of the easiest ways to deal with unrequited love is to dismiss it as a delusion, a dream that takes us nowhere. I think this is the easy way out. We don't have to tell ourselves we can't get anything out of the state of being in love unless it becomes a full-blown romance. As Lena's story shows, there are many in-between ways of being in love. Her feeling for Oliver is more than a friendship, but it's not a romance either. For that matter, it's not unrequited love, but it shows us what unrequited love can be at its best. Intense, fruitful feeling without expectations. Lena's daughter is a year younger than Clara. As Lena and I spoke in my living room one morning, the two girls played upstairs, making scary movies on my cell phone. They rushed down to show us what they'd done. On the phone's small screen, Lena and I watched their serious, horrified faces, their hair Sunday morning messy, their costumes a whimsical combination of camouflage and scissored-up Halloween garb. They were in that period of girlhood I remember so well, when imaginary play is all-consuming and a good book can take over the world on weekend afternoons. The idea of romantic love was still fairly incomprehensible to them, but it wouldn't stay that way much longer. I know that secure love and care now will help my daughter weather the storm later, hopefully with the same strong sense of self that she carries into her current friendships. I've also come to believe that our society as a whole could do a better job raising children to have healthy romantic relationships. We have a great deal at stake in learning to love. Good relationships are a major factor in quality of life, mortality rates, and happiness. Yet we leave courtship, the way relationships begin, largely in the vast realm of cultural mystery, said Brian Spitzberg, a communication professor at San Diego State University and a leading researcher on obsessive romantic pursuit. We don't teach it in school. It's not seen as an appropriate area of instruction. We allow people to learn it through trial and error, an extremely inefficient way of learning. There are all sorts of ambiguities in the process. We lose track of the bigger picture of what makes better relationships because we're trying to decode all the signals. We're trying to figure out how the other person feels and regulate our own emotions. A quality relationship ed program won't eliminate unrequited love, and I wouldn't want to eliminate it completely, given the beneficial role played by certain kinds of unrequited love in our lives. But if we can teach kids about sex in high school classrooms, is it so outlandish to propose that we also teach them about the human tendency to get romantically obsessed, what it might mean, and how to handle it with dignity? Can't we teach them about ways to cope with unrequited attraction and obsession, and how, when they're ready, to let it go? From the time Clara was quite small, I've found opportunities to talk about love and relationships, bringing in what I've discovered in the process of writing this book. When Clara was a kindergartner, she loved Peanuts, a comic strip that is all about unrequited love. Charlie Brown once famously bemoaned, "Nothing takes the taste out of peanut butter quite like unrequited love." The strip links its characters in chains of unreturned adoration. Peppermint Patty loves Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown loves the little red-haired girl. Sally loves Linus, who loves his teacher, Miss Othmar. Lucy loves Schroeder, who wants nothing more than to play Beethoven on his toy piano. In one of the comic strips, Lucy leans on the piano, asking Schroeder to tell her she's beautiful. When he doesn't, she announces, "If I go out of your life, it will become empty, and all your practicing will be as pursuing the wind." Without lifting his gaze from the piano, he replies, "Try me." But Lucy doesn't leave. She kicks the piano, believing the instrument to be her rival, the only thing standing in the way of Schroeder's love. When that doesn't do much, she flings the piano into the dreaded kite-eating tree, which chomps the instrument to dust. When Clara burst out laughing, I didn't try to stifle her glee. It's a comic, after all. But I didn't want the menace of the situation to go unnoticed, so I said, "It's really mean, what Lucy did. Schroeder loved his piano. Lucy is a lot more than an unwanted girl who went too far. She's authoritative, smart, and enterprising, with a lemonade stand-style psychiatrist help booth advertising a nickel a session. It's significant that the strip combines these qualities with her inclination to be rude and manipulative, suggesting that female ambition and the capacity for emotional violation go hand in hand. But this was something I told myself that I could bring up when Clara was older, if the opportunity arose. In that moment, the idea of mean, which any 5-year-old can understand, would be enough. Clara nodded. "Read some more," she said, eager, as always, to find something else that would make her giggle. As Clara approaches adolescence, I've shared bits of my own story of obsession, in greatly watered-down form, as a cautionary tale, though she insists she doesn't need it. I'm not going to get obsessed with a boy like you did, Mommy, she's told me pointedly more than once. She may indeed be right. If she's not, I hope I can be helpful, though I'm well aware of the tendency of kids to ignore their parents' advice, even if